ex-Europe trading facility. Island, of course, lurked in the background. Dave Cummings had based the BAT system on Island, and Chi-X had been coded by former Island programmer, later Getco executive, Brian Nagito. BAT's Chi-X Europe would handle more than 25% of all stock trading in Europe, making it the largest pan-European stock market. Like a dominant species taking over an entire ecosystem, Island's pool was washing across the globe. From NASDAQ, INET, the Island system with all the high-speed bells and whistles tacked on, had spread to 70 exchanges in more than 50 countries around the world. And inevitably, as the Island system spread, it brought along its codependent species, the high-frequency traders. Getco, of course, had established itself as king of the speed traders. In 2007, it had landed an investment of between $200 million and $300 million from private equity giant General Atlantic, a deal that valued the firm at roughly $1.5 billion. By 2011, that value was considerably higher. And the firm continued to bring on an army of quants to man its world-spanning trading machine. The following ad for Getco, for instance, appeared in January 2012. Chicago, Illinois. Work with interdisciplinary teams of traders and technologists and use trading models to trade profitably on major electronic exchanges. Use statistical and mathematical approaches and develop new models to leverage trading capabilities. Must have masters in math, statistics, physical science, computer science, or engineering with minimum GPA of 3.4/4.0. Must have proven graduate-level coursework in two or more of the following: stochastic processes, statistical methods, mathematical finance, applied numerical methods, machine learning. Then, in the summer of 2011, a new contender for the high-frequency crown had emerged: Virtu Financial, the computer trading outfit that counted former Island attorney and NASDAQ executive Chris Concannon as a partner, merged with EWT, a California speed trading operation that operated on exchanges around the world. EWT was run by Rodney Farragalla, a former technologist at Island. Industry insiders said the firm would handle as much trading as, if not more than, Getco. The arms race behind the algo war seemed endless. Speeds were hitting levels that defied rationality. A London technology company called Fixnetix claimed it had crafted the world's fastest trading microchip, a device that processed a trade in 740 nanoseconds. There was even chatter about measuring trades in picoseconds, trillionths of a second. A picosecond is to 1 second as 1 second is to 31,700 years. The SEC, alarmed by the explosion of trading and humbled by its inability to quickly explain the flash crash, rushed to come to grips with the market. To catch up with the machines, the agency planned to build a giant machine of its own. It called it the Consolidated Audit Trail, or CAT. The CAT, in theory, would be able to capture and analyze every single order placed into the stock market. This included not only the actual trades, but the mad frenzy of canceled orders clogging up the market's plumbing. The SEC hoped that its CAT would capture patterns in real time, much like an AI bot, and discern whether they were manipulative. The cost of such a machine was unknown, but experts said it could run in the billions. But few stopped to ask what the cost would be if nothing were done. Without the ability to peer into the market and learn who was doing what and why, the traffic police of the market were nothing better than Keystone cops. Rogue traders could act with impunity in the full knowledge that there was little chance that they'd be caught. While the CAT smacked of some kind of Orwellian eye in the sky, it also seemed almost incredible that it hadn't been built already. Because the terrifying truth was that the market by the late 2000s had descended into one vast pool of darkness. Insiders knew this to be true. As the market continued to evolve into a speed-mad runaway train with no barriers beyond the laws of physics, some of the trailblazers of electronic trading started to question whether things had gone too far. On the morning of October 11, 2010, Thomas Petterfy stepped onto the dais of the ornate Opera Salon on the ground floor of the Intercontinental Le Grand Hotel in Paris. It was a gala event, the 50th annual meeting of the World Federation of Exchanges. Attendees included Bill Brodsky, chairman of the Chicago Board Options Exchange, the NYSE's Duncan Niederauer, Christine Lagarde, French Minister for the Economy and future head of the International Monetary Fund, NASDAQ CEO Bob Greifeld, and Atsushi Saito, CEO of the Tokyo Stock Exchange. The speaker who would set off the most fireworks was Petterfy, the founder of Timber Hill, one of the early users of Island. He looked out over the podium at the upturned faces of his peers and grimaced. Petterfy had become extremely disillusioned with the market he'd helped create. It wasn't just the deceptive tactics of firms like Trillium. It was the unregulated speed traders who were picking off his own firm's orders, with no firm obligation to stick in the market during tough times. The stock and options markets had been turned into a wild west of dueling algos, and some firms, it seemed, had special advantages. Like Chaim Bodek at Trading Machines, Petterfy was steamed that his orders were getting clipped time and time again. He wasn't going to take the abuse without fighting back. He cleared his throat, adjusted his glasses, and launched into his speech. "An exchange used to be a place, yes, a physical place, where people would come together to buy or sell, hoping to achieve the best price for themselves," he said. "The more the exchange was able to attract all of the buy and sell interests in a product, the more the prices on the exchange would reflect the true state of supply and demand." It was the old mantra, liquidity breeds liquidity. But something had changed. "In the last 20 years came computers, electronic communications, electronic exchanges, dark pools, flash orders, multiple exchanges, alternative trading venues, direct access brokers, OTC derivatives, high-frequency traders. Reg NMS in the U.S. And what we have today is a complete mess." He looked out at the crowd. Dead silence. Petterfy hadn't bothered to warm the audience up with a joke, a humorous anecdote. He cut straight to the point. And most of the people in the room didn't like what he was saying. "It is not so much anymore that the public does not trust their brokers. They do not trust the markets, the exchanges, or the regulators either. And why should they, given our showing the past few years? To the public, the financial markets may increasingly seem like a casino, except that the casino is more transparent and simpler to understand." Visible tension spread through the room. Did Thomas Petterfy just call the market a casino? That was an attack they might have expected from the likes of Arnick and Saluzzi, or Senator Ted Kaufman. But from the founder of Timber Hill and Interactive Brokers, one of the godfathers of electronic trading? Petterfy, of course, was fully aware that his words seemed to contradict his own history. Like Josh Levine, he had believed that computers would revolutionize markets. And they had. But something had gone wrong.
"I must confess to you that I was an ardent proponent of bringing technology to trading and brokerage. Unfortunately, I only saw the good sides. I saw how electronic trading and record-keeping could be used to force people to be more honest, to make the process more efficient, to lower transaction costs, and to bring liquidity to the markets. I did not see the forces of fragmentation and the opportunity for people to use technology to keep to the letter but avoid the spirit of the rules, creating the current crisis."
He gazed out at his audience. Petterfy wasn't shocked to see the stern faces, the shaking heads and averted eyes. He was certain that he'd become their enemy, and he had little hope that they would listen. The computer trading elite would never admit that the markets they'd created were deeply flawed. Still, he kept hammering away.
"It is vitally important that we bring an end to this crisis of trust before it spreads any further. That we bring back order, fair dealing, and trust in the marketplace. The financial markets of the world's developed countries are at a turning point. Technology, market structure, and new products have evolved more quickly than our capacity to understand or control them. The result has been a series of crises over the past few years that have caused many investors to lose confidence or to think that the whole system is a rigged game."
After Pettifi finished speaking, there was silence. Then a scattered hand clap. And then the room burst into loud applause. Everyone realized. Pettifi had actually done it. He'd come out and said what so many were thinking, what they all knew deep down. The market was a complete mess. And the old guy was the only one with the balls to stand up there and call a spade a spade. It was a message Dan Matheson at Credit Suisse would echo a few months later in his speech at the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach. Soon after the speech, Pettifi was hobnobbing with the titans of the exchange world. He ran into Sandy Frutcher, vice chairman of NASDAQ and longtime chief of the Philadelphia Stock Exchange.
"How are you, Sandy?" Pettifi said.
"I'm well," said Frutcher, a gray-haired veteran of the exchange wars. "But I don't wake up in the morning thinking about which windmill to attack." Pettifi understood exactly what Frutcher was saying. In an ideal world, everyone would start behaving himself and stop focusing on the short-term buck, the quick hit. "We all know the truth. You know. I know. This is Wall Street. You're not changing a goddamn thing." In November 2010, 1 month after Pettifi's speech, the American Physical Society published a startling new study that made a radical prediction about the future plumbing of the global financial market. The paper was more proof that skeptics such as Pettifi had little hope of putting the brakes on the market's speed demon evolution. The paper, by MIT physicist Alex Wisner Gross and Cameron Freer, an MIT mathematician, argued that it's in the financial interest of high-speed trading operations to build computer hubs at specific, optimal intermediate locations between trading centers all around the world, between Shanghai and the Tokyo Stock Exchange, between the Tokyo Stock Exchange and NASDAQ, between NASDAQ and the London Stock Exchange. With these catbird seat hubs, the firms would be able to trump their competitors in the race to capture opportunities in price discrepancies in stocks between the venues, say Microsoft in New York and Microsoft in Tokyo, or West Texas Crude in Chicago and Light Sweet Crude in Amsterdam. It was a race that went all the way back to Dave Cummings' insistence that TradeBot's computers be co-located with Islands at 50 Broad. Wisner Gross and Freer provided a map dotted with optimal hubs all along the Earth's surface. Many of the hubs lay in the oceans, leading to the fanciful notion that particularly ambitious high-frequency trading outfits would plant themselves in the middle of the Atlantic or the Mediterranean or the South China Sea and get the jump on competitors using floating micro-islands populated by small communities of elite pattern recognition programmers overseeing the hyper-fast flow of data through their super-servers. Better yet, unmanned pods of densely packed microprocessors overseen by next-generation AI bots processing billions of orders streaming out of other unmanned AI pods positioned optimally around the world. The silent beams of high-frequency orders shifting trillions across the Earth's oceans at light speeds, all automated, beyond the scope of humans to remotely grasp the nature of the transactions. The end game for Wisner Gross and Freer had nothing to do with AI bots and picosecond arbitrage. Rather, they saw this rapid expansion of powerful computer power around the planet as a step toward a sort of digital planetary transcendence that humanity could use to observe the world itself on a scale never before conceived. The floating islands would come equipped with sensors and the technical ability to crunch massive sums of data. Predicting long-term weather patterns, or even solving global warming, would then be much more feasible. This is the first financially compelling reason to start to densely deploy computers all over the world's surface and make our physical planet smarter, said Wisner Gross. And yet few stopped to question the wisdom of linking every trading center in the world at blindingly high speeds. With optimized hubs connecting markets in a worldwide push-button money grid and vast trading machines juggling every security known to man, the possibility of a next-generation crash, global in scale, was becoming all too real. Such an event had been dubbed the Splash Crash. Chaotic pools of dark liquidity crashing like a tsunami across the world's trading system. now sprinkled into the toxic brew? Experiments on entirely new breeds of artificial intelligence. Chapter 23. The Big Data. Eli Vadopoulos, a.k.a. Acid Freak, stepped into Suite 1107 on the 11th floor of 156 Fifth Avenue and shook the soot-black snow off his shoes. It was early spring of 2011. Snow still clung to the sidewalks of New York after one of the coldest northeast winters on record. Inside the office, a row of high, dirt-smeared windows overlooking an endless cityscape in the Flatiron District of Manhattan let in a stream of grainy, lemon-yellow sunlight. The office of Kinetic Global Markets, a startup New York hedge fund, looked like almost any high-tech trading hub. Narrow tables stacked with rows of computers, glowering 20-somethings in jeans and sweaters and scruffy beards, mesmerized by darting streams of data on their Acer flat screens. Whiteboards sporting wild-looking flowcharts and complex formulas hung on the walls. The smell of cheap coffee wafted from a small kitchen by the office entrance as Vadopoulos walked in and pulled off his jacket. Flags for the native countries of various Kinetics team members, Greece, Israel, Italy, Russia, the United States, and more, hung on a string that curved along the ceiling over the monitor-stacked tables. Kinetic was trying to tap into what had come to be known among a cohort of AI aficionados as the big data. As computers spread across the world, more and more information was available about, well, everything. Shipping trends in the Persian Gulf, the amount of wheat grown in Kazakhstan, rainfall in British Columbia, birth rates in Latin America, oil shipments in the Strait of Hormuz. The list was endless. One fact was clear. The human mind could never process the big data. But a computer, perhaps? And perhaps a big data trading machine could troll the web and other data systems and discover patterns, untold patterns. Those patterns, if all worked as planned, could provide signals that a machine could use to buy and sell stocks for a massive profit. That trick, anyway, was what Kinetic and the trader formerly known as Acid Freak, Vadopoulos, were attempting to pull off. It marked a new shift in the application of computers to the market. With the boom in high-frequency trading, computers had, by 2011, easily defeated humans at the speed game. No human could trade hundreds of stocks in milliseconds. But now, programmers were attempting to build computers that could beat humans at the trading game itself, buying and selling stocks based on fundamentals, such as sales trends and economic variables. While the effort seemed almost quixotic, there were indications that it could be done. IBM, after all, had recently built an AI computer system called Watson that had defeated the world's elite Jeopardy players. The system Kinetic deployed resembled Watson in certain ways. Kinetic's task, however, was in reality far harder than cracking Jeopardy. Kinetic was trying to hack the market by mining endless terabytes of information stored on databases throughout the world. Its hacker-in-chief, Vadopoulos, was a charismatic, intense character with a shaved head, rimless glasses, a fondness for vintage tennis shoes, and a million stories. Many of those stories went back to his previous incarnation in the early 1990s as an infamous hacker, back when being a hacker was actually cool, the closest a computer nerd could get to rock star status. The hackers he ran with even had made up names like rock stars: Fiber Optic, Corrupt, Outlaw, The Plague, Lord Micro. Vadopoulos went by the name Acid Freak, P-H-R-E-A-K. In the late 1980s, he'd founded a group of elite hackers in New York City called the Masters of Deception. The MOD's specialty was hacking phone systems, a skill set known as freaking, hence Vadopoulos' sobriquet. They were very good at what they did. Too good. They hacked too many systems and eventually caught the eye of the feds. After getting caught for successfully hacking into AT&T's phone system, in July 1993, Vadopoulos and his partner in crime, Paul Stira, a.k.a. Scorpion, were sentenced to 6 months in prison and 6 months home detention. The charge was conspiracy to commit computer crimes. Vadopoulos seemed to have little trouble finding work after getting out of prison. His talents were in high demand from outfits that required protection from people just like him. At first, he worked on computer system security analysis for the military and intelligence agencies. Then he started researching the technology behind the stock market. And eventually, in 1996, he landed a job as Director of Global Information Security at Instinet. In 1998, he came into contact with the legendary founder of D.E. Shaw, a giant New York hedge fund that used math and computers to mine hundreds of millions of dollars from the market year after year. David Shaw, who taught computer science at Columbia University before jumping into finance, helped convince Lidopoulos that the big money on Wall Street wasn't in security systems. It was in designing computer models to trade stocks. It took years before Lidopoulos was able to build real-world models. To bone up on finance while working as a consultant for Instinet, he studied economics at the City University of New York. Then, in the early 2000s, he met David Lineweber, a finance professor at the University of California at Berkeley, who'd been working on applying AI to trading for more than a decade. Lidopoulos had been studying AI since the 1990s, but he wasn't convinced it could be used as an effective trading tool. Lineweber showed him that as computers grew more powerful and more data was available on the Internet, AI would eventually become a reliable way to predict the future course of the market. For a time, they teamed up at a technology firm called Monitor 110 that searched the so-called deep web for information that hedge funds and bank prop, proprietary, traders could use to guide their trading decisions. Operating out of a sixth-floor loft just north of Wall Street, the operation scoured more than 9 million sources of data, such as traditional news sites and blogs, for information on specific companies or on topics ranging from pharmaceutical trends to asbestos litigation. Lidopoulos worked for the research team that tested strategies. The results of the tests were used as a sales device, examples of how the system could work for potential users. At Monitor, Lidopoulos met Roger Ehrenberg, the cerebral founder of the company, and a venture capitalist who'd formerly run a $6 billion internal hedge fund for Deutsche Bank. Ehrenberg had been a longtime investor in Renaissance Technologies and was therefore well aware of the massive potential and the massive hurdles of using large-scale data and artificial intelligence to buy and sell stocks. It was possible, but only the best minds in the business, such as Bob Mercer and Peter Brown at Renaissance, seemed capable of pulling it off. Despite its world-beating talent, Monitor was a failure. It was a needle in a haystack business, and the firm found far too much hay and far too few needles. The information was overwhelming, impossible to spin into gold. The firm was wound down in 2008, and Lidopoulos' research team disbanded. A few years later, the germ of the research team's work gave birth to Kinetic. Lidopoulos, Ehrenberg, and several others who'd worked on the strategies were convinced that the core idea they'd formed at Monitor still had massive potential. Technology was improving at a dramatic pace. Cloud computing, the use of spare capacity on a distributed network of computers, was giving firms the ability to tap into glaciers of digital muscle power. Where Monitor had to buy and build its own server farm, a firm tapping the cloud could get the same processing and storage power at a fraction of the cost. Leaps in language processing and AI strategies also made the task of squeezing profits out of the big data seem more realistic. The biggest step? Shrinking the data set. The information superhighway was teeming with incalculable hordes of data that a smart trading system could exploit. The trouble was, as Monitor had found, there was far too much data. They needed focus, gold standard sources of information that could collectively feed a model and present winning trading ideas, rather than scan the entire web, as impossible as boiling the ocean. They would scale down the project to a more realistic goal. They went to work, building a database of websites and other machine-readable online sources, including government sites such as SEC.gov. To make sense of the information, Lidopoulos and several other programmers started to build an artificial intelligence program that could monitor the sites, hunt out recognizable patterns, and provide specific forecasts for stocks. The system might track respected blogs about Apple, such as MacRumors, speeches by industry experts, shipping data out of China, where iPhones were built, employment sites measuring the number of workers with Apple experience looking for jobs, an uptick would indicate a round of layoffs, hence trouble, and possibly an earnings miss. The system would scour SEC filings, data on Amazon.com or other retail sites that indicated sales performance, and Twitter feeds that mentioned Apple products. Collectively, the AI program crunched the information like a magical data grinder and spit out a buy or sell recommendation with a certain probability, much like a Wall Street analyst, or IBM's Watson submitting a response on Jeopardy. That, at least, was the theory. The goal? Predict a company's performance before it became public. Effectively, they were building from scratch an AI financial analyst. Ideally, Kinetic would be able to detect a company's fortunes even before the company's own executives and employees knew what was happening. Sales trends, buzz on a product, a pricing war coming from a tough competitor. They were crystal balls into the future. If only you could find the right data and make sense of it. So in 2008, full of big data dreams, Lidopoulos, Ehrenberg, and a small team of scientists, programmers, and mathematicians launched Kinetic. Their target was to create an AI-based trading system that could go live in 2011. The system would pick stocks only in the Russell 2000 Index, a collection of relatively small stocks that weren't always actively tracked by Wall Street analysts. Since there was less competition in small stocks, they were low-hanging fruit. But less competition also meant less information on the companies. That could be a good thing. The system wouldn't drown in oceans of data. But it was also a drawback. There weren't many people tweeting about Midas Inc. or blogging about Stanley Furniture, two companies in the Russell Index. Even scaled down, though, the amount of available information the machine would need to crunch in order to draw a realistic picture of the world for a specific company or sector was enormous. It was a smaller pond, but it was still the big data. One service Kinetic used was Celerity, a news search system that deployed AI techniques to rapidly scan and interpret earnings releases for its clients. Celerity's algorithms would crunch through earnings numbers and hunt for red flags, such as a big loss hidden in a footnote, charged words such as bankruptcy or default or merger would trigger rapid alerts that Kinetic's trading machine could act on in milliseconds. Sometimes this process struck gold. In January 2011, Celerity, using a trick deployed by too clever for their own good active traders, plugged in an online address for Microsoft's earnings based on the address used in past releases. At 2:50 p.m. Eastern Time, the release suddenly appeared. But Microsoft hadn't put the link to the page on its website yet, thinking it remained hidden. Microsoft was wrong. Celerity instantly downloaded the information. Its AI bots went to work, sending the information to Celerity's clients, who were able to trade for instant profits. Kinetic wasn't up and running by then, however. In fact, Kinetic was having an immense amount of trouble launching its strategies. It had initially planned to go live with its trading system in February 2011, but the system wasn't ready. AI programmers such as Lidopoulos kept tweaking the system, throwing more data at it, in the hope that the machine would find the pot of gold at the end of the big data rainbow. There was hot debate inside the firm about risk controls and which inputs to use in the AI system. The challenge was enormous, but the payoff seemed limitless. The Kinetic team kept working all hours. Work-free weekends became a luxury. There was a firm commitment to the machine, a belief that the machine was always right. One telling conundrum concerned how to label Kinetic's strategies. It was difficult, because AI techniques by their nature could change over time. One month, the strategy might cause the machine to pick cheap stocks. The next, it might chase high flyers. We have to be careful not to fool ourselves into thinking that the models we are creating should necessarily be treated like the name we are giving it, a Kinetic researcher wrote in an email to the rest of the research team. For example, if we assume that a model is truly a momentum model and try to manage it at the portfolio level as such, we may be hurt when the model stops behaving like a momentum model. That probably creates some challenges for how to manage our models at the portfolio level. The machine crunched through a myriad of strategies. It would track the difference in trading volumes over the previous day, or the difference in price volatility, how much prices rose or fell, over a 5-day period, or a 10-day period, or a 21-day period, or a 63-day period. It tracked the exchange rates between the dollar and the euro, the dollar and the Japanese yen, movements in treasury bonds, the average range between high and low prices on the New York Stock Exchange. The signals could get dizzyingly arcane. One signal was the maximum singular value of correlation matrix of all pairs over the previous 63 days. It wasn't working. In its test runs, Kinetic Strategies, for reasons that baffled Lidopoulos, lost money, albeit fake money, far more often than they made money. Kinetic was discovering that trading was far more complex than simply discovering signals in the market. Firms had to carefully measure their impact on specific stocks, whether their buy and sell orders were pushing prices around. This could be especially problematic for the small stocks Kinetic was trading, since few other firms were buying them on a regular basis. An order to buy a few thousand shares of Stanley Furniture could cause the stock to jump quickly. The reason? Other AI bots with order detection systems on the lookout for whales. If Kinetic kept buying as the stock shot higher, the trade could easily end up a loser. In other words, while Kinetic's signals might have been spot on, its ability to execute the trades in the market was woeful. Lidopoulos had massively underestimated the ability of hunter-seeker bots to detect his orders, trade ahead of him, and run up prices. As the summer of 2011 wore on, Kinetic's dream of creating a foolproof AI trader proved increasingly elusive. The strategies weren't working. The data proved too difficult to manage. Some inside the firm started questioning whether Lidopoulos knew what he was doing. They thought he relied too much on machine learning, while not understanding fundamental quant strategies. Lidopoulos countered that it was not advisable to muddy the waters of the AI strategies with human influences. Kinetic researchers also frequently debated a question: when to turn off the machine? The answer? Never. The machine was perfect. "We are not going to stop trading," an internal Kinetic email stated in the summer of 2011. "We need to be trading every day unless we encounter a severe drawdown, which is not possible given the risk management controls we currently have in place." It was almost a religion, a faith in the power of the machine above all else. The machine knows all. Trust the machine. Another discussion concerned the difference between rules-based trading, the static, straightforward approach of the past that used trading models with fixed parameters, and the machine learning approach, the dynamic, shifting, flexible method in which the computer learned on the fly how to trade. Ideally, the latter approach gave the machine the ability to adapt to the market as conditions shifted. The machine encompassed all possible strategies. We are not testing a hard-coded strategy over time. We are testing the ability of an algorithm to adapt to changing circumstances, one Kinetic email stated. But what if the machine somehow started tracking a bubble? The signals created by the bubble could cause the machine to start buying bubble stocks. Don't worry. The machine knows. Although consistent machine learning performance could correspond to some bubble, I think this type of problem would be less likely in a machine learning approach, the Kinetic email said reassuringly. It would be easy to unintentionally engineer a rule to correspond to some bubble. However, with our machine learning approaches, we are frequently retraining based off our data, which is constantly being renewed. In general, I think we have to be careful with applying evaluation techniques that are used with simple strategies to approaches that are capable of dynamically adapting strategies over time. The problem was, the machine wasn't making money. So the Kinetic team, led by the one-time acid freak, kept pushing the system, feeding it more and more data. Unfortunately, the team's faith in the machine was misplaced. In August 2011, Lidopoulos and his research associates were fired by Kinetic's board of directors. While Kinetic had failed, the dream of creating a thinking trading machine lived on. And why not? Futurist Ray Kurzweil has predicted that as computer power and artificial intelligence expands to the point that it has the capacity to improve itself, computers effectively designing and creating more computers, the nature of humanity will become irrevocably altered. A fearsome event he calls the singularity. Ultimately, Kurzweil says, we humans will bend the robots to our will, allowing us to transcend our biological limitations. Less well known is that Kurzweil has tried to bend AI to a more prosaic goal, making money. In 1999, Kurzweil launched a hedge fund based on complex mathematical strategies called FATCAT, short for Financial Accelerating Transactions from Kurzweil Adaptive Technologies. FATCAT deployed algorithms to ceaselessly comb through the market for new trading opportunities. The algorithms competed against one another in a Darwinian death match. The algos that made the most money survived, the weak died off. FATCAT, in Kurzweil's eyes, represented the future of Wall Street. The inventor envisioned a future marketplace in which human beings had little input into day-to-day trading decisions. Rather, intelligent robots would be in control, swapping stocks with one another in a globally interconnected cyber matrix. In an ideal world, that would make the market less prone to the all-too-human frailties of fear and greed. Only the numbers, the cold, hard facts, the ever-flowing streams of data would matter. There was little question the computer revolution that made the AI dream a reality was irrevocably altering financial markets. Information about companies, currencies, bonds, and every other tradable instrument was digitized, fast as light. So-called machine-readable news was a hot new commodity. Breaking news about corporate events, such as earnings reports, was coded so that super-fast algorithms could pick through it and react. Media outlets such as Reuters and Dow Jones published machine-readable news that pattern recognition computers scanned and reacted to in the blink of an eye. High-tech trading firms gobbled up the information and gunned orders into the market at a rate faster than the beating wings of a hummingbird. With masses of data streaming through thousands of miles of fiber-optic cables laced around the world, and more people plugged into the web through social networks, entirely novel techniques for leveraging data for trading were cropping up. Twitter and Facebook, Google and YouTube became the new tools of intelligent trading machines, looking to unearth the latest shift in retail sales or gauge the mood of entire populations. While a few outliers such as Renaissance, Automated Trading Desk, and Getco deployed AI techniques known only to themselves, most firms over the years found AI to be severely limited as a trading weapon. It seemed to work only for very short-term horizons, a few hours, a minute, a second. Trying to project results beyond a few days seemed beyond the abilities of a machine. But with new breakthroughs toward the end of the 2000s, AI was coming into its own on Wall Street. As data measured by the petabyte, 1 quadrillion bytes, blasted across the Internet every day, Google, for instance, processes more than 24 petabytes a day, programmers with the right set of skills were attempting to marshal the latest breakthroughs in AI to find order in all the streaming chaos. It was the age of the big data, an era designed for and by AI aficionados such as Renaissance's Bob Mercer, whose mantra was, "The best data is more data." Now, access to data was exploding at rates impossible to fathom. Kinetic showed that the big data was very hard to hack. But some other firms were having success. Case in point, a small startup based in San Francisco called Cerebellum Capital. A pair of AI experts were behind the firm. David Andre, a scientist with a PhD in AI studies from the University of California at Berkeley, and Eric Astro Teller, a director of Google's New Projects division and grandson of hydrogen bomb creator Edward Teller. Andre and Teller had known each other since their days studying math and computer programming at Stanford University in the early 1990s. The two teamed up a decade later to run Body Media, a Pittsburgh-based company that marketed wearable computers that could help guide a client's diet. The system relied on AI techniques designed by Teller and Andre to crunch massive sums of data collected through the hundreds of thousands of users of the devices. They started discussing other uses for AI technology. Repeatedly, finance came up. To an AI scientist, Wall Street was tantalizing, a vast system of digits and information scattered across multiple platforms. Andre and Teller theorized that just as their AI system crunched the waves of data spit out by their body media devices, a similar but more sophisticated system could find order in the seeming chaos of the financial markets. It was a powerful and compelling idea, but the two had virtually no experience on Wall Street. One day after work, at a bar in the riverfront Station Square section of Pittsburgh, they discussed the pluses and minuses of making the jump into finance. "It's a heartless, soulless world," Andre told Teller. "We wouldn't be helping the world like we are now. Right now we're changing people's lives." Teller argued that they should view the project as an experiment, a way to conduct research on AI outside of a university setting or a large corporation. "The success of the program will be proven by the results," Teller said. "Plus, if successful, the research would fund itself." That appealed to Andre, and they decided to make a go of it. They got an initial round of seed investing from several longtime acquaintances and started building their trading machine. With virtually no employees, they realized that they could exploit situations that much larger ventures might skip over because they weren't lucrative enough. Just as a great white shark might swim past a pool of tiny fish, large investors regularly skipped over small, slightly profitable trades. What's more, since Cerebellum would be discovering the strategies, the cost of doing business would be lower. No expensive traders demanding huge year-end bonuses. Like the Kinetic team, they were in for a few rude shocks. Trading on Wall Street wasn't remotely as simple as it had first seemed. Large firms always had an advantage, since they were able to negotiate better terms with brokers and exchanges, lower fees, quicker data feeds, etc. It was also hard to raise money with virtually no track record. Big investors such as pension funds were a non-starter. They would never put money into a startup, especially one with just a few million in assets under management, and pie-in-the-sky talk about mining the market for trading gold through AI. Still, they forged ahead. In July 2009, they launched the Cerebellum Alpha Fund with just over $1 million in capital. Andre and Teller called their machine learning program the Invention Machine. Using genetic algorithms, digital robots with programs that evolved through time, the Invention Machine ran simulations of various trades and tested them for positive or negative results. The algorithms, like mini-robot traders, would mutate and breed, much like Kurzweil's fat cat algos. The machine would kill off the traders that had done the worst and shift money to the traders that performed the best. This would lead to mutations in the strategies, entirely new algorithms. The Invention Machine ran this pattern hundreds of thousands of times a day, constantly combing through corners of the market, while at the same time crawling through internet sites for potential clues that could provide predictive signals. Generation after generation of computerized mini-bot traders dying and breeding and mutating would lead, eventually, to profitable strategies. Or so they hoped. Andre and Teller spent a great deal of time hunting for unique ways to grab information from the internet. For instance, one way to gauge the bullishness of traders in a way that's not currently measured might be to ping the online restaurant reservation site, OpenTable, looking specifically at expensive haunts around Wall Street. Heavy bookings might signal that traders had grown optimistic about the market's prospects. While that signal alone would never be enough to trade on, when added to dozens or even hundreds of other signals, a clearer picture might emerge. Deploying such techniques, Cerebellum's Invention Machine struck gold. Andre and Teller discovered an anomaly in the market that appeared to generate a nearly perfect, steady return of about 7% a year. By trading in and out of stocks and options, they won't disclose which ones, they could exploit a wrinkle in the market that no one else knew about. They quickly segregated the strategy into a new fund. They called it the Cerebellum ATM Fund and launched it in December 2009. Investors piled in. By the summer of 2011, the ATM Fund had amassed $50 million in assets. The experiment seemed to be working. AI could mine the market for strategies, discovering new trades and new possibilities. A fierce believer in the powers of the computer, Teller became convinced that the future of Wall Street lay in artificial intelligence. If people could trade, so could computers, but much better. Chapter 24 Advanced Chess. Chaim Bodick rushed out the front door of his home, jumped in his all-black Mini Cooper, and sped to the train station in downtown Stamford, thrash metal pounding from the car's speakers. It was the morning of March 25, 2011, his last day on the payroll of Trading Machines. Bodick was scheduled to give a speech later that afternoon at Princeton University, at a conference called Quant Trading, From the Flash Crash to Financial Reform. As usual, he was running late. He hadn't written his speech yet, so he banged it out on his laptop on the train to Princeton. It was hard. He wasn't sure what to say. He'd grown so cynical about the market that he'd become convinced that massive reform was required. But he didn't know if he should be the one to spearhead changing the rules of the game. He worried about his career. Whether the new elite at the high-speed firms and exchanges who'd built the market's digital plumbing in the past decade would attack him and make it hard, if not impossible, for him to build another trading operation. He had a wife and three young children to support, and he was out of a job. The role of market reform gadfly wasn't high on his list of priorities, but his creeping belief that the market had been hijacked kept bugging him, like a bee buzzing in his face, and it wouldn't go away. In his talk, Bodick went halfway in calling for major changes. He spoke about the structural issues facing the options market, the evolution of algorithmic trading, and the negative impact stock market structure changes were having on the options industry. There was no mention of toxic order types or zero-plus scalping strategies. He wasn't ready to take on the whole system, yet. Matt Andreessen also spoke at the conference. The year before, the one-time Island CEO had left his high-paying job at Citadel to launch his own computer trading outfit in Chicago, Headlands Technologies. Andreessen told his audience that top-shelf traders today need to know much more than quant strategies. They also need to have a deep understanding of market microstructure. They need to know the plumbing. Another speaker was Andrei Kirilenko, who'd conducted in-depth research into the flash crash for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Kirilenko had discovered that high-speed gunners typically traded in the direction of the price movement of a stock for the first 5 seconds of a move, then flipped and traded in the opposite direction after 10 seconds. On May 6, 2010, they followed the same strategy, but faster. The speedsters bought in the direction of price movements for the first 2 seconds, then reversed direction after 4 seconds. Later, a speaker on a career panel discussing jobs in quant trading said more universities needed to focus on high-frequency trading as a career. Bodick couldn't believe it. Short-term flipping had nothing to do with real trading, he thought. The ability to take risk and make money on it, that's what mattered. The market had boiled down to a spy war of secret codes that exploited fraction-of-a-second glitches in the market's plumbing. As Thomas Petterfy had said, it was a complete mess. Just a week before, former Goldman programmer Sergei Alenikov had been sentenced in a New York courtroom to 97 months in prison for stealing Goldman's trading code. In February 2012, a federal appeals court overturned Alenikov's conviction. Earlier in the month, another algo trader, Samarth Agrawal, was sentenced to 3 years in prison for stealing high-frequency code from the French bank Société Générale. Was this the future for the U.S. stock market, whose purpose was to give companies the ability to raise money and investors the chance to tap into the growth of the global economy? The industry wouldn't have a chance, Bodick thought, if someone didn't stick his neck out and start taking on the madness. Riding the train home that night, he decided it might as well be him. Months later, Bodick sat typing in a cramped room. It was just past 7 p.m. in the summer of 2011. He was testing a new trading platform on the SGX Singapore Exchange, which had just opened, and he liked what he was seeing. Trading Machines, Bodick's firm, had been wound down months before. But Bodick wasn't going down without a fight. Operating from his home in Stamford, Connecticut, working out of a small office lined with computers, charts, and books, he was building new systems based on the hard lessons he'd learned in the brutal markets of 2009 and 2010. Screeching Viking metal pounded from speakers as Bodick combed over the data showing the results of his latest tests. He wasn't working alone. While most of Trading Machine's staff had left for new jobs, a few were sticking it out for the new strategy Bodick was building. There was Mark Shaw, a quant who'd worked alongside Bodick since his days at Hull Trading in Chicago in the 1990s, as well as Brian Weiner, a trader who'd earned his chops on the floor of the Chicago Merc, trading S&P options contracts. Bodick felt like he was working against a stacked deck. Something had happened inside the plumbing of the stock market that had destroyed the strategies he'd learned during his years at Hull, Goldman Sachs, and UBS. High-frequency traders had become so powerful, so ubiquitous, that it became virtually impossible to trade stocks without getting clipped time and time again. Bodick knew his complaints sounded like excuses for failure. Critics would say he couldn't take the heat, but he was convinced there was more to it. Exchanges and high-frequency firms had been working hand in glove to design a system that gave an advantage to the speedsters. The speed traders had been working closely with the electronic pools for more than a decade, from Island to Brute to Archipelago. They'd pushed for more speed, for more information, for new exotic order types, and the pools complied willingly. It all added up. In Bodick's eyes, there was nothing implicitly wrong with what had happened, at least at first. The relationship between high-speed firms and exchanges was in ways beneficial for all investors, he thought. The bots pushed for better execution. That made the markets better for everyone. But a problem developed. High-frequency trading became so competitive that on a truly level playing field, no one could make money operating at high volumes. Starting in 2008, there had been a frantic rush into the high-frequency gold mine at a time when nearly every other investment strategy on Wall Street was imploding. That competition was making it very hard for the firms to make a profit, without using methods that Bodick viewed as seedy at best. It all came down to maker-taker, the trading incentive conceived more than a decade earlier by Josh Levine. According to an academic study by a finance professor at the University of Illinois, by the late 2000s, profits on rapid trading of NASDAQ stocks had turned negative, when accounting only for the spread between buy and sell prices. That meant the only way certain high-frequency firms, such as the scalper variety that profited on the difference between bids and offers, could make money was through maker-taker rebates, the fees they collected when other firms had to trade with them. The trouble for the exchanges? Everyone wanted to pocket the rebates. Every reasonably sophisticated firm, including trading machines, was putting orders into the market designed to earn the rebate. That posed a conundrum for the exchanges, Bodick theorized, because everyone couldn't get the rebate. Everyone couldn't win, because for every winner there had to be a loser. It was a zero-sum game. Simple math. And so, Bodick reasoned, a complex system was designed to pick winners and losers. It was done through speed and exotic order types. If you didn't know which orders to use and when to use them, you lost nearly every time, which is exactly what happened to trading machines. Worse, if you weren't getting the rebate, you were paying the fee. For a high-volume operator, the difference could mean a loss of tens of thousands of dollars a day. To Bodick, it was fundamentally unfair. It was rigged. There were too many conflicts of interest, too many shared benefits between exchanges and the traders they catered to. Only the biggest, most sophisticated, connected firms in the world could win this race. Is that fair? Is that a level playing field? One apparent consequence of this hyper-competitive market was its fragility. Because high-speed traders were now competing for wafer-thin profits, they'd grown incredibly pain-averse. The slightest loss was unacceptable. Better to cut and run and trade another day. The result, of course, was the flash crash. It was an algorithmic tragedy of the commons, in which all players, acting in their self-interest, had spawned a systemically dangerous market that could threaten the global economy. Bodick knew he'd made mistakes. He'd wasted months trying to hunt for a bug in the code of the machine, when the problem was actually abusive order types. Then he'd started using the order types himself to protect his firm from the abuses. But it felt dirty. He'd become one of the bad guys, one of the tipped-off insiders. Kill or be killed. He didn't like it, but it had become a matter of survival. Bodick knew he wasn't alone. Thomas Petterfee, one of his idols, had been complaining loudly about high-frequency trading. He'd read the speech Petterfee had given at the World Federation of Exchanges. He also believed that Petterfee wasn't aware of how the toxic order types worked. If the founding father of electronic trading was in the dark, what chance did ordinary investors have? It was not how the market should work. Investors should be rewarded for their intelligence, for being able to make accurate predictions and take risk, not for knowing the location of secret holes inside the plumbing, or worse, creating the holes. That was Bodick's biggest complaint. The plumbers had won. And the SEC seemed content to help them along. A telling example emerged in June 2011 when the SEC approved a program created by BATS that would give certain traders with exclusive rights better prices than the general public. Market makers using BATS would be allowed to send two prices for an options contract to the market. One price, the worst price, would be displayed to the market. The better price would be dark. Only brokers that operated through the select market makers could get the better price. Only insiders could tap it. Indeed, under heavy criticism, BATS later backed down from the program. But it had tipped its hand, showing that it was more than ready to give certain clients a better deal than others. Bodick became determined to reveal what he believed was a corrupt insider's game that came at the expense of everyday investors. Was it outright collusion? He didn't have enough hard information to know for certain. Perhaps the exchanges that had rolled out the toxic order types were ignorant of the devastating side effects they could have. Perhaps, giving them every last benefit of the doubt, they believed they were doing investors a favor by rolling out orders that pulled in more high-frequency flow. The more bot flow, perhaps they thought, the more liquidity, tighter spreads, etc. In his heart, Bodick didn't believe any of that. He believed the exchanges were locked in cutthroat competition, not only with one another, but with the dark pools and the internalizers like Citadel and Knight. It was a dynamic that went all the way back to the late 1990s, when Island, Archipelago, Instanet, and other electronic networks were engaged in a kill-or-be-killed Darwinian struggle. That struggle led to massive innovation and changes, and to be sure, benefits for nearly all investors. But something else had changed along the way. The competition had become toxic, Bodick thought. The exchanges' backs were against the wall, and they'd made a deal with the devil at the expense of regular investors. And would those investors care, anyway? The toxic orders and all the other side effects of the system shaved only pennies off of every trade, after all. Who cares about pennies? That, of course, was what they were counting on. Investors wouldn't care. And if investors didn't care, lawmakers in Washington wouldn't care, and the regulators wouldn't care either. Bodick did care, however. The rigged market, he believed, had helped destroy trading machines and ruined all the dreams he'd put into it. But there was no way for him to know with 100% certainty the truth without some serious help. To that end, in the summer of 2011, he decided to explain it all to federal regulators. He hired a major law firm to help him use his understanding of toxic order types he'd gained from his exchange contacts while at trading machines, combined with the details of his understanding of high-frequency strategies he'd learned from the Zero Plus Scalping Strategy document, to lay out a roadmap. The roadmap detailed his argument that high-speed traders and exchanges had created an unfair market that was hurting nearly all investors. Bodick wasn't the only one raising red flags about toxic orders that catered to a specific kind of trader. Justin Kane, a trader for Seattle money manager Rainier Investment, had been growing increasingly frustrated as he watched order after order from his firm get whacked. He decided to speak his mind at a market structure conference at the downtown Marriott in New York City on December 6, 2011. He was on a panel alongside Direct Edge executive Brian Harkins and Virtu's Chris Concannon, the former Island lawyer. Kane for years had worked as a market maker in Jersey City, and he knew all the tricks the insiders played. Electronic traders, he told the audience, were using many of the same tricks the human market makers had used years ago. Worse, he said, exchanges were helping them get away with it. Visibly agitated, Kane launched into an all-out attack against the high-speed market. His specific target? Order types. Order types are being created to attract predatory traders, he said. The market, Kane complained, had been twisted to cater to high-frequency traders, since it's in the economic interest of the exchanges to provide the traders an environment that is most conducive to making a profit. If the traders are making money on an exchange, they'll keep coming back. But how can an exchange provide such guaranteed economics? An efficient market is one that brings together the buyer and the seller, Kane said, a statement Josh Levine would surely have condoned. But this marketplace is set up to bring in the most intermediaries between the buyer and seller as possible. They were doing this in part through order types, orders that Kane said were harmful to our clients. He recounted a story in which he complained to one exchange that provided the toxic orders.